You're listening to Latin America in Focus.
Latinoamérica en foco.
América Latina en foco.
A podcast by America Society, Council of the Americas, on politics, economics, and culture in the region.
This is Karin Zissis of ASCOA Online. 4 in 5 Latin Americans live in cities, and that's more than twice the rate of those who did in 1950. How did these urban areas, which define the lives of the vast majority of people in the region, grow and take on the characteristics we still see today? From now until the end of June, you can see for yourself in our exhibition, The Metropolis in Latin America. The show traces the urban growth, sociopolitical upheavals, and cultural transitions that, from 1830 to 1930, reshaped 6 capitals. Buenos Aires, Havana, Lima, Mexico City, Rio de Janeiro, and Santiago de Chile. My colleague Luisa Lemmy spoke with the exhibition's co-curators, Idure Alonso and Maristela Casquiato of the Getty Research Institute. They talked about how these 6 cities broke with the colonialism of the past to become laboratories of urban planning moving toward modernity. But first, we hear from Eugene Zapata Garche of 100 Resilient Cities. I first spoke with Eugene in the fall of 2017 after Mexico City's devastating September 19th earthquake. We caught up again in March this year on the sidelines of a Mexico City summit that brought together representatives from Quito to Cali to Christchurch and other urban areas around the world to share experiences for earthquake preparedness. I asked him if Mexico City's recent earthquake served as a wake-up call for those other cities and how.
This is a very good question. This morning we were looking at a presentation from some of the chief resilient officers of cities that have undergone earthquakes in recent years or in the last decade. And one piece of information that struck me was that the awareness of the population as to the risks and vulnerabilities of their lives and their belongings after an earthquake is always more important in the immediate aftermath of the earthquake. And when time starts to pass and weeks and months and years go by, people forget about how important this was. So what we are learning today is that an earthquake is an opportunity to take advantage of that wake-up call and revisit all the protocols that are in place. Because a few years later, people will not be as open and as active to engage in the needed changes to become less vulnerable and more resilient. So this is a finding of this morning. That's why Mexico City really wanted to convene this exchange with experts from around the world and make sure that the opportunity 6 months after the earthquake is seized properly and that we don't start these very hard, sometimes, conversations on how to turn Mexico City into a more resilient city in a year's time or in 2 years' time. It's going to be too late. Today, the issue is warm. People have it, you know, in the tip of their fingers and in the tip of their tongues. So this is the moment to talk about how to change the city and transform the systems and transform the way the city government and the population has responded to an episode like the one that happened on September 19th.
And interestingly, if you think about it, you think about a state like California, where you've had earthquakes in the past, but it's been a while. And so you're talking about this idea of like, you got to kind of strike while the iron's hot. Now there's been some time since California experienced a really major earthquake. Do they look at Mexico City and say, hey, this is something that we have to do. We have to look at their experience. This is something that they're doing right. Or this is something we need to do differently. Have you been hearing anything from or it could be from Quito, I know from Cali.
Totally. Mexico City thought that it was better prepared for an earthquake after the big earthquake of 1985. And there was a lot of things, there were a lot of things that changed. We spoke about this in the last interview. Mm-hmm. Building codes, protocols for early alarm systems, and other things. But 1985 is very different from 2017 and 2018. So two things that I can point to that are very important and proved crucial for the response of the earthquake in this city was the existence of social media. Mm-hmm. Back in 1985, there were no social media, that's one. And the second one is the way the public bike system helped mobility when the roads were blocked for security purposes. There were no bike share systems in Mexico City at the time. So these two things is just an example of many other things that have changed recently and that allow other cities like Los Angeles, San Francisco, Christchurch, Wellington, other in the Americas and beyond, mm-hmm. to look at an earthquake version 3. Mm-hmm. Not because of the different geological characteristics of the earthquake itself, but of the different society and the different world where the earthquake is happening. So I'm very surprised to see this morning our guest from Kyoto saying we haven't had a big earthquake with social media yet. So your experience in Mexico City is going to prove very useful for us to prepare because social media was one of the most important channels for citizens' response, but it was also a very chaotic source of information. Mm-hmm. So these cities are looking at Mexico City today as a new generation of earthquakes because it's happening in a new world.
Yeah. Talking about a whole new world, I wanted to talk to you today also a little bit about issues like elections and longevity, because one thing about a resilience plan is it's really something that's long term. So for example, in Mexico City, there'll be an election in July, and we'll be seeing a new government come in place, and there's a resilience plan in place. And as I understand it, Mexico City might have something that's different from other cities in that the idea of resilience is enshrined in a new constitution. So I wonder if you could comment on that. Does that protect the resilience plan? Can a new government still come in and kind of put pressure on a resilience plan to prevent certain aspects of a resilience plan or shift course? And how does the fact that, does that make it different from other cities with resilience plans that might not be so protected because they don't have it enshrined in their Magna Carta, so to speak?
Continuity in public affairs is a big, big challenge for Latin American cities. Because there has been a culture of mayors coming and going with their own teams and with their own programs. So every time a new mayor comes into place, into office, he or she has its own priorities. And there's been a very difficult path towards continuity from one government to the other, especially when there's a change in political parties. So resilience, as you mentioned, yes, it's about the long term. You cannot make a city more resilient in a couple of years. And it's not only the long term, it's a permanent effort. It's forever. I mean, earthquakes are going to happen here, unfortunately. So this has to, and as we have mentioned, the world changes. So we have to adapt our strategies and our policies. Mexico City has really made a big, big effort to guarantee or to shield its resilience strategy against these changes. First, as you mentioned, as by embedding resilience in the city constitution, which is a brand new document that gave autonomy to the city in opposition to what it was before, just a federal district. It has also published the strategy as a legal document in its official journal, which is, this is new, this was last month. It also created, the day before the earthquake, the Mexico City Resilience Agency with a general director and a staff to do this. And the law provides for the resilience strategy to be implemented by all city entities. Mm-hmm. But what is more important is that the strategy to make this city a less vulnerable one is owned by others beyond the government. Private sector, the academia, universities, NGOs have, to a certain extent, not all in the same level, have been participating with the city government to think the future, not only in an aspirational way, but in concrete ways also. It's something that it's challenging for all, but it's the only way forward. So the long term is about institutionalization. It's about legal framework, the proper entities, the proper offices and staff to deal with it. It's about political will of authorities that want to continue. We have seen just recently in Santiago de Chile, for example, a change of authorities. The mayor, Intendente Claudio Orrego, has just left. There's a new Intendente who came, and she tweeted the first week of her appointment that the resilience strategy was a policy of the state, and that she was going to respect all the work that had been done by her predecessor and the stakeholders that were engaged. So I do think that Latin America is getting closer and riper to this path. It's the only way forward. We cannot interrupt resilience building every other year just because a new mayor comes in place.
Across the world, we're seeing sort of a trend towards anti-establishment candidates. You know, in Rio, for example, which also is part of the, has a resilience plan, is working on a resilience plan, there was a new mayor who was sort of an outsider who came in. And you can see that in, for example, Brazil overall, they're having a presidential race and there's some anti-establishment candidates. And there's a lot of talk about that in the Americas, in part because obviously in the United States, you've had a change with having a president come in and take the country out of the Paris Accord. So one thing I'm interested in seeing in asking you is also about how do you handle it when there's someone who comes in who you can't, isn't predictable? Another aspect of the question is in the United States, there's been this idea that cities can lead. How do you see a reflection of that in Latin America?
I have seen mayors come and go, change priorities, bury all the programs from the previous government, come up with good and bad ideas to reinvent their cities. And this has done a lot of damage to the continent. But this is changing. I believe in institutions, and I believe in the rule of law, and I believe in the bigger and more important weight that civil society has today in decision making. So I think Latin America is less and less vulnerable to that sort of authoritative, dictatorial, completely unjustified decision making. We have this word in Spanish, capricho. I don't know how you say it in English, but it's like capricious child that just wants his or her way and doesn't want to know. Mm-hmm. I don't think politicians that are capricious have a place in our continent anymore, and we're seeing it with those who are really not opening their ears and their eyes to dialogue and negotiation, that they are not getting any further. I do think that cities in the world, and Latin America is not the exception, are leading the public policy agenda. They're closer to the citizens, they're closer to the people, they deal with day-to-day problems of the neighbors, of the families. They are the most legitimate politicians that citizens know and recognize. I can bet you right now that you don't know, you would not recognize the photo of your representative in Congress or your senator in Congress or your deputy people know who the mayor is, and mayors of medium-sized and big cities have a lot of capital in all terms, financial capital, because they have budgets and their cities are economic engines and powerhouses. They have institutional capital because they lead a government that has the tools and the administrative procedures to make things happen. They have political capital because they were elected and mandated to play that role. And they are also innovating. So yes, I do believe that cities and mayors are in the best place to be sitting at the table of world affairs. Climate change is one of those very important topics where the states, the nations, the heads of state have been less ambitious and less daring than mayors, but not only. We're seeing it in migration issues, for example, where mayors step up to welcome migrants when governments are building walls. And we've seen it also in social cohesion. We're seeing it also in human rights. There's, in this country, Mexico City was the first authority to authorize marriage of same-sex couples and the legal interruption of pregnancy in a very Catholic country. So yes, mayors are innovating. They have the power, and they can lead the way.
Thank you very much for taking the time again.
You're welcome.
Thank you. That was Eugene Zapata Garache, Regional Director for Latin America and the Caribbean at 100 Resilient Cities. Check the podcast notes for a link to my prior conversation with him. Next up, how did Latin American cities transform in the post-independence period? Luisa Lemmy got some answers from Maristela Casquiato and Edure Alonso.
Thank you so much, Edure and Maristela, for being here at the America Society with me today.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the invitation to talk to you today.
We'll be happy to talk about the exhibition and more.
Great. Iduri, can you talk a little bit about how this exhibition idea started? Where did it come from?
Let's say that I was working on another exhibition for Pacific Standard Time, Los Angeles, Latin America, this initiative by the Getty Foundation, which was an exhibition on photography from Argentina. As I was researching the collection of the Getty Research Institute, trying to find photographs of Argentina and other Latin American countries, I realized that we had an amazing collection at the GRI of photographic images of the cities in Latin America from this time period, from the 19th century and early 20th century. So I thought about this idea of putting together an exhibition about the urbanism and the changes in these capital cities in Latin America during this period. Then I was very fortunate that Maristela came in to the GRI as the curator of architecture. And so we decided to work together in this project.
There are six cities in the exhibition, mm-hmm. right? So correct me if I'm wrong, Havana, Lima, Mexico City, Rio de Janeiro,
Buenos Aires,
and Santiago de Chile.
Yes.
I forgot the southern coast. See, that's not good. And Endure, what do we see then, you know, from those places, what do we see in the exhibition? What kind of image can we, you know, since we are in a podcast, can you describe a little bit what people will see when they come and visit?
Well, we have different types of materials in the show. I would say that probably 80% of the show are photographs from the time period. So you'll see in the case of Brazil, of Rio, we do have at the Getty Research Institute a very important collection. We have the Gilberto Ferrez collection, which was the grandson of Marc Ferrez, one of the most important 19th century photographers in Brazil. So in the case of Brazil, it's mostly photographs, but we also have very important maps that I think is a great combination, because then you see the photograph and then you can see in the map where those areas are located. So for example, we do have a map from the 1900 from Mexico City that shows Reforma Avenue, and then next to it you have the photograph of the statue of Cuauhtémoc, which is in Reforma, and then you also have photographs of Reforma. So it's like a combination of different materials that build up one to another.
I would add, Idure, I think this is an important aspect, that doing this research, looking at the collection, you also find confirmation of how much certain media, like the photography, the photographers and the photography, was really the media representing the transformation of the city. Those photographers were really fascinated by these new avenues, the new parks, and so on. When Idurre mentioned this large Ferrez collection, I mean, those family of photographers and the photographer really worked for the administration. I mean, so the photography is a tool, a device for the administration to leave traces or witness of their work. I mean, it's an interesting, I mean, an almost unique way of working between the photographer and the administration.
Well, yeah, because what is happening during this time, and I think we, maybe the viewers are not very clear on this, the photographers during this time are working most of the time through commissions of the government. So what is really interesting to me, for example, and this is something that we had trouble finding, and it's not because it's lacking in our collection, it's because something else, is that we wanted to show also the more the people from the lower classes or the disadvantaged as part of the urban fabric of this period. And it was very hard to find images. Why is that? Because they were invisible for the photographers. Again, why? Because the government was not interested in showing the quote-unquote ugly aspects of the city. So it's also interesting to look at all this photographic production as a way of generating a specific idea of what the city was, putting forward this idea of a modern nation, but at the same time erasing some aspects of the city that didn't go along with those ideas. And so photography, because it has always been attached to this idea of being the true, a true representation of the reality, it was the perfect tool to generate this idea of modernity, but it's leaving out some other aspects of the city.
And build a whole new identity for those Latin American cities. This is one of the moments of the exhibition, right? The Republican period shows this break to the colonialism, to colonial architecture, or to things that were there since the discovery of Latin America. And then there is another period of time that it's more infrastructure, modern architecture. Can you talk a little bit about those two different periods, those two different moments and projects that you see in the exhibition?
The city is a political object, no matter where you look, I mean, Republican, post-colonial, or contemporary. I think that, in effect, what is so interesting in this 100 years that the chronological frame of the exhibition is that there is a continuity under a major concept. The concept is modernization. Modernization means, I mean, making the city affordable in terms of infrastructure. Now, affordable for certain classes more than others, but generally speaking, making the city modern, giving the city the aspect where electricity is an important component, water, sewage, embellishment. So the modernization is a kind of continuous fil rouge, I mean, that goes from the Republican to the neo-colonial, to the Spanish Revolution. I mean, there is not a contradiction there. There is more, a difference in maybe specific styles, search for certain different architectural language, nuancing in certain aspect of the decoration and so on. But the modernization is the key word. I mean, modernization and progress. I mean, we want to become modern. We want to become, cities of the world, European, North America.
So we're not talking about a break, as a negation of what came in the past. We're talking about evolution.
Yes, yes. And of course, when we talk about the break with the colonial past, even though maybe In the writings of the intellectuals, they address that and highlight that the reality is that the colonial aspect of the city remains, specifically in cities that were very important during the colonial era, like Mexico City or Lima. Also, the plaza, which is the center of the colonial city, stays as the center of the Republican city. So, as Maristela was saying, this is more like a continuation or a transformation, but it's hard to talk about break. One thing is what the intellectuals were writing about, and another thing is what actually happened.
Maybe, I mean, there is also, I mean, the economic components are different from what the city, how the city is getting its own new image. I mean, of course, there are nations in Europe that become extremely relevant economically as a power in Latin America. So, I mean, there is not any longer the Portuguese of the Spanish Empire, but you have the British Empire because they are using the raw materials and so on. But this is part of the evolution of the economic capitalism, that it's in the history of the transition between the 19th century and the 20th century. The urban fabric answers a bit more slowly to that. So you really see transformation under the keyword of a continuity.
That's great. And then, you know, how do we transport these ideas for what happens today in the cities? We talked a little bit about modernization and answering problems that were, you know, a reality for people at the time: sewage, basic infrastructure, electricity. This will come from Europe, right? I remember that the electricity company in Rio is until today called Light in English because it was a British company, right? So how do we see those issues that were so present at the time and we will see in these photos, in this exhibition, transform to today's reality?
When you think about some of the ideas that are thrown out in the exhibition, especially speaking of the displacement of people in the city through these like major changes, that has to do and is completely connected to certain problems that persist today. Let's say that the Pereira Passos transformation of the center displaces a lot of people and creates favelas. And so people think that the favelas are something contemporary, but actually they're not. They're from this time period, that this is the beginning of that. We also have to think that this is a moment where we have waves of people coming from the rural areas, coming into the cities. This extreme growth that is happening, that is going to be even more later on, of course, but this is the beginning of that. So many of the problems that the city faces today are very much connected to many things that were happening in the late 19th century. And I think we need to think about that. Like, gentrification is not new. When you look at the panorama view of Havana, and you think how these new neighborhoods were being constructed, and so people were moving out from certain areas to go to another one, I mean, the wealthiest people, generating gentrification. It's interesting how some certain things that we think are contemporary, they're actually not, and they have their beginning during this time.
Yeah, there's a continuation of the space. So the space also changed, right, Manistel?
Well, the space changed, and Idurre right now mentioned, for instance, the beautiful panorama of Havana that it's presented in the exhibition. It's a very detailed print, and you see the port, of course, one of the most important of the Caribbean, and one of the reason of the wealth and the relevance politically also of Havana in the history of that part of the Latin American regions. But then you see the grid, you can see the beginning of some opening of the grid with the new Paseo, but what you see so clearly are the new areas of the let's say, bourgeoisie neighborhood. And you see the beginning, for instance, of what is called, even still today, the Vedado. The Vedado is a very interesting area in Havana. It's a garden city. So it's a kind of reinterpretation of the European, British, I would say better, model of the garden city. But it's so clear in this image that there is a kind of the urban fabric progressing. There are new areas, and you see how much this is, a process that it's very slow, but it's really visible in this material. And it's also the city of today. You'll notice also in the beautiful map that we have of the period when Noel was the mayor of
Buenos Aires.
Buenos Aires. What the map shows now are really all this extension of the Greek city, the original colonial city, with new neighbors. They are basically garden cities. And through this garden city, they introduce another urban fabric, that is the large avenue a la française, Haussmannian, we may say. So also this idea that models are over superimposing and that there are layers, it's something that you also have in the contemporary city. Mm-hmm. So this is an exhibition that tells a lot to urban historian, to architect, about this continuity, and which I think it's important, as Idurre was also mentioning, not much of this history has been so much researched. Mm-hmm. And there is not a gigantic literature. There is a limited literature, because it's, in a way, the contemporary city with the problem, but also the post-World War II, modernization, it's more attracting. You really have to dig into the archive to find evidence of the 19th century city.
That's great. This exhibition was in Los Angeles, like you mentioned before in the beginning of our conversation, and now is in New York. It's going to stay in New York until June. Can you talk about the value of showing this exhibition and this history and these commonalities with cities today to other megalopolis of the world, like Los Angeles and New York?
I think these things that I was talking about, this idea of the displacement, gentrification, and so on, is something that is very present in our lives in big cities. So I think it's an exhibition that makes you think about that and the reasons of that, and how it's done, and so on. So I think it's interesting from that perspective. But in the case of New York, I think it's clear, no, that there's many issues presented in the exhibition that also pertain to a city like New York. I don't know.
Well, yes, and not only that. I think that the American society in this case plays a very important role in making clear that there has been a kind of shift. The Republican city is more looking to Europe at the beginning, because the US, the North American planning model, was in a way not really that open, advanced, like the Viennese or the Parisian one. There is only the Chicago school, in a way, as an urban model. And that was not immediately applicable. So now, this
did
is...
Did it answer to different problems?
Exactly. So that what's happening now, we're coming back to New York, and then we are showing, that in fact there has been an appropriation of European models, and now there are also North American models that are part of this development. So I think it will be a great, also quote unquote, surprise and discovery for the New York people. To see how much it was, the US was in a certain way distant from the Latin American in the 1830s, 20s, 35, and there is immediately a European taking advantage, and then comes again the North American model and reappropriation. So I think there is a lot of understanding on this at the global level today, which I guess it's also another contribution of this exhibition.
This is great. I am delighted to speak with you guys today. It was very interesting, and the exhibition is indeed beautiful. It will stay open in New York City for visitation until June. So thank you very much for today's talk.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
The Metropolis in Latin America, 1830 to 1930, was organized by the Getty Research Institute in Los Angeles. The exhibition is on view from now through June 30th, 2018, in our gallery at 680 Park Avenue. Get more information at as-coa.org/metropolis. Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Karin Zissis. This episode was produced by Luisa Lemmy. The music was recorded at America Society in New York City. Check out a list of upcoming concerts at musicoftheamericas.org. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. If so, please subscribe and leave us a review at iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, or Stitcher.